Translation. O great sage, time annihilates everything in due course of time. So how is it that this subject matter, which happened prior to this day of Brahma, is still fresh in your memory, undisturbed by time? So we see here that Vyasadeva is quite marveled that even though Narad went through this experience as a young boy in a previous day of Brahma, which, as we know from the Gita, is quite a long time. As you know, Vasahasra Yuga Paryanta Mahadyad Brahmano Vidu, Krishna explains that, you know, you take 1,000 ages together, which means 8,600,000 years. You take that 1,000 times that, 8,600,000,000 years, that's 12 hours of Lord Brahma. Right? And then such, same as his night. So, what is it, 16, 17 billion years ago, this is what happened to him. And he's relating it like it happened 5 minutes ago. Yeah. And even we understand, or even we experience, you know, something that happened just a few minutes ago. What was that? I can't remember, you know. Or you read something, and just like you know, I was talking to Govinda just before, and he's saying, I read something, you know, the other day, and you can't remember where it was or exactly what it was. That's how fickle our memory is. It just comes and goes so quickly. And Vyasadeva is expressing that here. He's expressing that, you know, time just erodes everything. And we see that. Time's the great destroyer. Krishna declares this in the Gita, that everything, you know, time brings down everything. And it doesn't matter the greatest civilization, the most powerful person, whatever it is, in this world, even it mentions the mighty Himalayan mountains, in time they'll become nothing. And that's just the nature of everything in this universe. So here he's saying, you know, time, you know, it erodes everything. So how is it you remember that? He's quite perplexed. And I find this relationship between Narada and Vyasadeva is quite extraordinary. Because here we see that Narada Muni is taking the role of the guru. But who is Vyasadeva? Huh? Yeah, we go back to the 21st verse of the previous chapter. It's really interesting. Narada's in no illusion who Vyasadeva is. No illusion at all. This is what, you know, this astounding nature of these personalities. Where is it? He says here, is it 21st verse? Yeah. He says, Parasya Pungsang Paramatmana Kalam. So you know what kala means? Plenary portion. When they use this word kala in relation to the Supreme Personality of God, it means a plenary portion. So he's saying Pungsa, right, which means the Supreme Lord, the Personality of God, Paramatmana. So who's the Paramatma? Lord in the heart. So he's saying that you're a plenary portion of Godhead. You're the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Why did you make this mistake? You know, because he's chastising him in the previous chapter. He's chastising him for his presentation of the Vedic literatures. In the second verse of this chapter, he says, are you happy identifying with the body and the mind as a self? Really strong words he's speaking against at Vyasadeva here. And we see if we go to the 11th verse of this chapter, that well-known Tagbhag Bhishago Blipado Janatago verse. In there, in the purport, and also in the commentaries by Vishnath Chakravarti Thakur, you know, Prabhupada makes the comment, and also Vishnath Chakravarti Thakur makes the same comment, that Vyasadeva wasted his time writing these other books. He should have just written the Bhagavatam, because the other books have no benefit in this age of Kali at all. The only book in the age of Kali, as we see, Krishna Svat Dham Pagati Dhamma Gana Visaha, Kalo Nashti Jishamesha Puranako Dhradhara, that this Bhagavad Purana is as brilliant as the sun, has arisen just after the departure of Lord Krishna from his own abode, to give persons in this age of Kali light. They'll actually see, you know, their situation in this material world, because as we see right in the beginning of the Bhagavatam, it points out that this Bhagavad Purana kicks out all this other stuff that maybe confused people. Because we see, just like, you know, Vyasadeva, he took the Veda, he divided it into four, then he thought, well, maybe people won't understand this, so I'll write the Vedanta Sutra. You know, we'll give a commentary on this so people can understand. And then he wrote the Vedanta Sutra, and we see the result of Vedanta Sutra. Has anyone read Vedanta Sutra? not easy to understand. And there's so many commentaries on it. And the most prominent commentary on it is Sarirakibhasya. And where does that lead people? Complete confusion. You know, they just see that, you know, that I am God, you are God, we are all one. You know, this is what Vedanta Sutra is brought about. And it's interesting because Vyasadeva, seeing the nature of people in this age, he reflected upon this and he was thinking that I have to do something for them because they're suffering. They don't understand who they are. You know, the religious qualities are much less in this age. You know, and he was seeing how religiosity, truth, charity, austerity, all these types of things are greatly reduced in this age. So he was thinking, I have to present, you know, philosophy in a way that they can actually digest it. So then he divided the Veda, he wrote the Vedanta Sutra, he did the Itihasyas and things like that. And it actually didn't have the result he was hoping for. He was hoping it would inspire people to, you know, seek out the absolute truth, but actually it had the opposite result. And they just watered, everything was watered down. And so then he was seeing that, and therefore we see in the end of the fourth chapter, the beginning of the fifth chapter, he's feeling despondent, that he didn't actually achieve what he wanted. And this is quite extraordinary because he's the Supreme Personality of Godhead. All his activities must lead to ultimate fruition because he's God. Everything he does is perfect. So even though it doesn't lead to fruition, it's also perfect. How is that? How is it that, you know, even though he's feeling this dissatisfaction, even though his intended purpose didn't come, you know, his work didn't bear fruit, how is it that it's perfect? If we look at this section up to chapter 19, this first canto of the Bhagavatam from 1 through to 19, what is it leading to? Anyone know? What happens in chapter 19? The appearance of Sukadeva Goswami. This is what this whole section is leading to. It's leading to the appearance of Sukadeva Goswami. What's the significance of the appearance of Sukadeva Goswami? He speaks the Bhagavatam. So this is all about Krishna's play to manifest the Bhagavatam. It's the same with Arjuna. Arjuna was put into bewilderment. How can Arjuna be put into bewilderment? He's Krishna's eternal associate. He's always with Krishna. And in the fourth chapter, Krishna says that. He says, many, many births both you and I have taken. I can remember them all, you can't. Because Krishna's the Supreme Person of Godhead. Arjuna's a jiva. He can't remember them. But he's always with Krishna. Narayana Rishi. He's always with Krishna. He's a perfected living entity. But by Krishna's arrangement, he's put into illusion. And we see here, by Krishna's arrangement, Vyasadeva. It's kind of interesting. Vyasadeva is Krishna, but by his arrangement, he's put into, if you like, not really illusion, but it's just like this pastime plays out. Now, Narada's position is really interesting because he knows that. He knows what's going on. It's not like, you know, he's in some illusion that this is, you know, someone else and he's just my disciple and he's forgotten what's going on. He knows exactly what's going on because he's like the, if you like, in a sense, like a puppet master. You know, and the puppet master is sort of like directing the play of the puppets, you know, to present the pastime or whatever. And we see so many times, just like when Devaki and Vasudeva were in Kamsa's prison, right? Narada knew what was going on. He knew that the eighth child would be Krishna. And so what does he do? He goes and speaks to Kamsa and says, hey, look, you know, it could be any one of these children. You better kill them all, just in case. But it's not like he's engaged in some sinful activity. It's not like he's getting reaction for that. He's a perfected spiritual living entity. He's completely completely above the influence of the most material nature. Whatever he does has no reaction or sinful or pious. He's completely above it because he's completely transcendental. And he's just acting in a way to bring about the manifestation of Krishna's pastimes. So we see here the same thing. He's speaking to Vyasadeva like he's a disciple who's made a mistake, even though he understands that he's the Supreme Personality of Godhead, even though he understands Vyasadeva's role is to manifest the Bhagavatam. He understands that. Therefore, he's carrying out his role perfectly. And so he addresses him. He says, you know, you've made a mess here. And I'm going to give you instruction to fix up. So it's quite extraordinary that, you know, and he takes the role so perfectly. He takes the role of guru very perfectly, because what we see here, and also Vyasadeva takes the role of disciple, because what's happening in the beginning of this chapter, this fourth chapter, is that Narada's revealed to him, you know, he's told him a little bit in the end of the fifth chapter about his previous life. And then Vyasadeva is very, very excited to know how his guru achieved perfection, taking the role of a disciple. Now, if someone was not a devotee of Krishna, or someone didn't have access to the commentaries of the Acharyas, which is really, really important. I was listening to a class two, three days ago about the 11th canto, 16th chapter, and the speaker was talking about, because this verse was, I can't remember which verse it was, maybe 8, I think it was, and it's, no, sorry, it was 40 and 41, that's where it was. And in the commentary on 41, Prabhupada's disciples, they quote many different references from the Acharyas, from Jiva Goswami and Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur and Sridhar Swami, and establishing just a few interesting points there in the verse. And the speaker was saying how it's really important to understand these things through the Acharyas, because without the commentary of the Acharyas, we can't really understand the deeper meaning of these pastimes. You know, someone might just read these. I actually remember when I was a young devotee reading this section in the Bhagavatam, and my conclusion was Vyasadeva was in Maya, because I wasn't really, you know, studying deeply the commentaries of the Acharyas. But actually, we can see through studying the commentaries of the Acharyas how we understand more deeply what is actually happening here. It's not that Vyasadeva is in Maya, but actually he's acting out a pastime to help the Bhagavatam to be manifest, you know, to facilitate Sukadeva Goswami appearing on the scene and interacting with Parikit Maharaj, and then, you know, so that both Sukadeva Goswami and Parikit Maharaj will be glorified through speaking and hearing the Bhagavatam and through the whole pastime. Because we see also with Parikit is quite an extraordinary personality, very, very, you know, great person. And he was able to sit there to hear the Bhagavatam for 7 days and seven nights without eating or sleeping or drinking or going to the bathroom. Nothing. He just sat there and heard the Bhagavatam continuously. Could any of us do that? You know, even to sit and hear the Bhagavatam for 45 minutes is often a challenge. You know, or to sit down and chant our rounds without, you know, being distracted by a gadget or talking or whatever, it's a challenge. But Parikit did this for 7 days. It was his only purpose was to hear the Bhagavatam. Yet we see, we back up a few days or a few weeks or whatever it was, that when he was out on a hunting expedition, he got separated from his hunting party, and he was wandering around, you know, lost, which is kind of quite extraordinary that, you know, the king of the world gets lost. I find that in itself is quite extraordinary. And we see that he started to feel very hungry and very thirsty. And he came upon this Brahmin who was in meditation, sage in meditation, who was just absorbed, completely in samadhi. And he's saying, "Hey, Brahmin, you know, give me something to drink. I'm thirsty." And then the Brahmin, you know, he's not recognizing that he's in meditation, which is itself is extraordinary, because he's a Raja Rishi. He's not an ordinary king. He also himself practices meditation and enters into samadhi. Part of his regular, you know, daily practice. So how is it that he didn't recognize that? How is it that he didn't see that he was in samadhi? And then how is it he's starting to feel hungry and thirsty, yet he can control himself so much so that he just sits down listening to the Bhagavatam? Thirst, hunger, tiredness, none of that stuff is existing for him. It's only a few days later. How is that? It's the arrangement of Krishna. Krishna's making this arrangement for the Bhagavatam to manifest for the benefit of all the living entities. Because Krishna says himself, it's said in the third chapter that this Bhagavat Purana, it's arisen for persons who have lost their vision due to the dense darkness of ignorance in this age of Kali. It's the only solution in this age of Kali. It's the only shastra which is actually going to help people to find, you know, the ultimate goal, to actually understand our purpose. Because it kicks out all this cheating types of religion. It kicks out all this misinformation. But even we find in the Bhagavatam, there are things that are hidden. I was listening to these classes from Banaswami the other day, really, really amazing classes. Because in London they're going through the 16th chapter of the 11th canto. And Bandaswami was giving class on the 3rd, 4th and 5th verses. And he was quoting, he was pointing out how in the Bhagavatam it's actually not revealing everything. You really need to sort of, you know, it's a bit like an onion. You need to peel off the layers to actually get to the real essence of it. Because right at the end of the Bhagavatam, what does Sukadeva Goswami say to Parikshit Maharaj? What the ultimate conclusion is? Anyone know? Right at the very end of the Bhagavatam. Huh? No, that's not the conclusion he gives. He says, impersonalism, this is the solution. And it's really extraordinary because if you look at the whole Bhagavatam, the point he's making is just what Rabindra said, is the holy name. This is the essence of all religious practices. Yet his very concluding instruction is impersonalism. Take shelter of Brahman. This is the solution. So he's just showing what we call a furphy. He's just showing this misinformation in there to confuse people who aren't really serious about understanding the truth of Bhagavatam. And so we see there's things like that all throughout the Bhagavatam. So therefore, this is why we need to understand the Shastra through the eyes of the Acharya, through the eyes of the liberated personality, because we see these things, this is right. It's, you know, impersonalism is the conclusion. So it's very, very important. And same here. It's like he's asking Narada, how is it that you can remember all these things? So the Acharyas, we'll see in the commentary here, the Acharyas are saying, Prabhupada's commentary, that it's transcendental knowledge. Transcendental knowledge is not affected by time. Transcendental knowledge is always complete. It's always revealing. It's always illuminating. Whereas material knowledge, anything material, decays. Just like in this section we were reading yesterday in Soho Street, it was talking about the different. Krishna was winding up. It's part of the Uddhava Gita. It's Krishna's instructions to Uddhava. So Krishna was winding up. The chapter's called The Lord's Opulences. And he was winding up the instructions on his opulences to Uddhava. And then he says there's two, you know, I've described two different types. And even the way this is presented, he just by the change in Esha and Esha, he's saying Esha means the spiritual opulences. Esha meaning just short A, is the opulence, or no, Ete, sorry, Ete. Esha and Ete. Ete means these opulences manifest in this world, material opulences. And he explains, you know, Jiva Goswami explains just by these different words you can understand the difference between the spiritual and material. And he's saying spiritual opulences, it doesn't matter. If we look at the Supreme Personality of Godhead, right, Mother Yasoda may have one perception of him. Or we can think of, you know, when Krishna entered into the wrestling arena in Mathura. All these different personalities were looking at Krishna and seeing him in a different way. You know, the wrestlers were seeing him Kamsa was seeing him as death personified, the wrestlers were seeing him one way, the ladies were seeing him as the most lovable object, you know, the men were seeing him as such a handsome young man. You know, they're all seeing him differently. But it didn't change who he was. It didn't change his essence as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Yet, when Krishna manifests his material opulences in this world, you know, like, for instance, Jiva Goswami gives the example of Indra. Indra's of a vibhuti of Krishna. Otherwise, how could he do the work he does? Or the same with Brahma. He's a vibhuti. He's blessed with the shakti of Krishna. Otherwise, how could he create the universe? When he appeared on the lotus, he was bewildered. He had no idea what to do. And he was looking everywhere, trying to find out his source, where he came from. And he couldn't figure it out. And then he meditated by the inspiration of the Supreme. He meditated. And then it was revealed to him. So he was actually blessed with the shakti of Krishna. He was actually able to understand. And so the point that Jiva Goswami makes there is that with these material vibhutis, if someone, say for instance, he was talking about Sachi, the wife of Indra, or Jayanta, the son of Indra, or Brihaspati, the guru of Indra, you know, Sachi is thinking, he's my husband. Jayanta is thinking, he's my father. Brihaspati is thinking he's my disciple. He's saying that's not a vibhuti. This role of being the son or the husband, this is not a vibhuti because of material. So the material perceptions are changed by our mental condition, our mental state, how we observe things. So it was a really interesting analysis of it. And we see just by these two words, Jiva Goswami and Vishwanatha Chakrabarti Thakur were able to reveal to us what the verse is actually saying. And similarly here, we see that the way the acharyas expand and explain these simple points, it actually helps us to really deeply understand the essence of what's going on. I'll read Srila Prabhupada's purport to further this point. As spirit is not annihilated even after the annihilation of the material body, so also spiritual consciousness is not annihilated. So Prabhupada's pointing out the difference between matter and spirit. A conditioned living entity cannot see that, cannot perceive that. Because when we look at someone, what do we see? We see the body. We see the interaction of the modes of material nature. And for us, that is reality. But someone who's a liberated personality, they look at this and they can understand the deeper essence. They see that this body is just a lump of matter. It's temporary. But the spirit self is not temporary. The spirit self is eternal. So because Narad Muni, he's a transcendental living entity. He's not sort of conditioned or controlled by the modes of material nature, just like we see Krishna points out in the beginning of the third chapter of the Gita. How the living entity, verse 5, I can't remember the Sanskrit right now, but he points out how the living entity is forced to act according to the modes of material nature and cannot refrain from acting in that way even for a moment. We're all forced like that. Every living entity is forced like that. You look at a dog, a male dog, for instance. You look at their activities. Do they ever stop to think that, oh, maybe I should be doing something different? No, they just go about dog activities. You look at any person in this material world. According to the conditioning that they have from the modes of material nature, it forces them to act in a particular way. Just like I've been staying in central London for the past month, and you get to see that, day and night. Like, 2 o'clock yesterday morning, the people next door, there's like, it's loud. Every night there's these loud conversations, Or like, what was it was on recently? The World Cup, right? And it just shows you how people are influenced by the modes of material nature. The World Cup was on, so they're watching the football game, and there's all this yelling and screaming coming out the next door flat. I thought the guy was killing his wife. He was yelling and screaming. So, he's really aggressive in his thing. I thought there was a big fight going on, and he was killing his wife or something. And then I said it to Merlius, and I said, what was going on? Was he killing his wife or something? He said, no, it's just the World Cup. So because of the way they're affected by material nature, they act in that way. But we see here, Narad Muni, he's not affected by that. So when he goes from one existence to the next, or from one body to the next, if you like, he remembers completely what happened in his previous life, because that knowledge, that transcendental knowledge, is awoken within him. Krishna Surya Sama Maya Hayandaka Yahan Krishna Tahanai Mayaraka. The influence of Maya has no effect when Krishna is there. When there's light, this Krishna Surya Sama, this complete knowledge of Krishna, when it's there in the heart, then it has no, the influence of Maya has no effect. And Narad Muni's like that. The influence of Maya has no effect on him at all. But sometimes we see, for Krishna's pastimes, to facilitate Krishna's pastimes, he becomes influenced by Krishna's internal potency, not Krishna's external potency. It's a difference. We're influenced by Krishna's external potency. We're trying to get ourselves under the influence of Krishna's internal potency. And it's such a simple shift. Prabhupada makes the point, to go from the external to the internal is such a simple shift. And this was one of the points that was being discussed in this purport yesterday, about the shift from the external to the internal. It's simply understanding that everything is actually Krishna's energy. There's nothing in this world that's not coming from Krishna, as Krishna himself says in the beginning of the Chatta Sloki of the Gita, Hamsavasya Prabhu Mata Sarva Prabhatate, that everything external, material and spiritual worlds, it all comes from Krishna. So if we can accept that, if we can understand that, everything I see in this material world, nothing is here for my enjoyment. Everything is here for Krishna's service. Even my own body is not here for my enjoyment. My body is simply here for Krishna's service. If we can start to see that, how everything is simply Krishna's energy, therefore is here to serve him, then we start to become gradually freed from the influence of the mother's material nature. Because what is putting us under the influence of mother's material nature is this desire to try to control and enjoy the material nature. As long as we think that we've got this potential to control and enjoy the material nature, rather than actually controlling material nature, what happens is we become controlled by material nature. That's what's happening, is because we're trying to exploit, we're the ones that are getting exploited. And we don't even see that. And that's like, you know, these people who are conditioned by the material nature, you see it like in big cities, you see it so much. They're in very difficult situations. They're thinking they're having a wonderful time. They're thinking that life is good. But actually we can see they're struggling so hard in the material nature. They're working so hard. They work long hours. Like, you know, in Merle's apartment is surrounded by office buildings. And you see people, they come early hours of the morning, like 6 a.m. they're starting. 10 o'clock at night sometimes, because we're doing a course here right now, sometimes we're getting back quite late. And you see, 10 o'clock at night, they're still working. So they're struggling very, very hard. You know, and they're not satisfied. They're working hard and they're not satisfied. You know, they're taking intoxication to try and get happiness. I remember we went up to Leicester for Rath Yatra, and then we went to the car park, and there's all these little silver cylinders on the ground. It reminds me of when I was a kid, my mum used to have one of those what do you call those things where you put gas in, those carbonizing things, you put gas into water and you make soda water. They look just like those. And I said to Millie, I said, what are all those things? He said, oh, they're from these vaping things, you know, this e-cigarettes. And so, you know, they're so dissatisfied. And there's thousands of these things in this car park. It's just like, almost like it was carpeted with all these little bottles. And so we see that people, you know, that they think they're getting satisfaction, but they're finding their satisfaction from something external to the self. So this is indicating they're not satisfied because they're having to try and, you know, more and more try to find some satisfaction. They're not satisfied in life. True satisfaction comes within. And we see these great personalities like Narad Muni. He's not, you know, he's not having to go down to the local pub to have a beer or something to find his satisfaction. He's not vaping or anything like that. He's completely satisfied in his realization, in his understanding of God, and in his relationship with God. He has a tangible relationship with God, so much so that he's participating directly in Krishna's pastimes here. And he's understanding fully his role, and he's understanding fully what Vyasadeva is doing. He's understanding it fully, and he's knowing that this is leading to manifestation of the Bhagavatam. Narad Muni is such an extraordinary personality. Consciousness of the material body means spiritual consciousness expressed through the medium of the material body. This consciousness is inferior. So we see, like, even though it's material consciousness, we see it as material consciousness, it's still spiritual consciousness coming through a filter. It's just like light. If you look at light, the nature of light, right? Generally speaking, light is white. But if you put it through a filter, just like we see these lights on the altar here, they have all these different controls where you can have pink lights, blue lights, orange lights, anything you like. But the original light is white. And especially if you use these, I don't know if you have, some places you see them, like, it's not so common these days, but, you know, I mean, sure, Jayadev remembers from his, you know, past life, doing all this rock and roll stuff. And you know, they have all these lights up and they put filters in front of the lights. And it gives you, it'll give you like a blue wash or a pink wash or whatever, you know, it changes the color. But the light that's actually going through starts off being white. So it's the same here with our material bodies. This body functions like a filter. You have a male body, a female body, Australian body, American body, English body, whatever it is. It's a filter. But inside you have the pure consciousness. But because we have this filter, we're seeing things through this filter, then when it comes out through this, you know, combination of goodness, passion, and ignorance, then it manifests in a particular way. But originally the consciousness is pure. So it's the same thing. So Prabhupada's explaining here, the consciousness of the material body means the spiritual consciousness expressed through the filter of the material body. So if you're a particular material body, you see things in a particular way. You know, some people are very influenced by passion. And so they're very lusty. So they see everything in this material world as a means of enjoyment. Another manifestation of passion is people are very greedy. So then they see everything in this material world as a way of making profit. How can they make money out of it? How can they improve their material opulence? But someone who's a devotee of Krishna sees everything in this material world simply for the service of Krishna. How can I use this in Krishna's service? And we see that with there's many, you know, very, very expert preachers in ISKCON, and they're actually branching out and doing so many different types of preaching efforts that were not so prevalent going back 10, 20, 30 years. Where I live in Australia, we have this thing called Krishna Village, and it started out being a woofing program. I don't know if you know what woofers are, but they're people who come and they work for free on organic farms. So the farm we have there, all the produce that's grown there is organic. So that enabled us to get these people to come and do woofing. And so they started up this ashram. And what we found is like, you know, part of their program is they had to come and do service at the temple every day, you know, to offset the cost of their accommodation. And so they were coming and cutting up vegetables and, you know, for the Sunday feast or breakfast or whatever, or cleaning the prasadam area and looking after the gardens and stuff. But while they're cutting up the vegetables, there's a kirtan playing, you know, and it's just outside the deity kitchen and stuff like that, so they get mahaprasadam and they, you know, what they're eating every day is prasadam. So gradually it has this process of purification that, you know, that they start to overcome various material desires, and they start to ask, you know, what is it you guys are doing here? You know, they start to ask about that, or they come to the Bhagavatam class or attend Mangalati. And then what happened a few years back is the government changed, you know, which has happened all over the world, they changed the visa program. You know, they cut out these things called 457 visas, which meant you could come and work in Australia for a certain amount of time, and you know, but they don't have that visa anymore. So we had to completely modify this program. So now what it is, it's a yoga teacher training school. You know, so they set up this yoga thing. They did, I don't know, 5 or 6 yoga teacher training, very cheap. It's like, I think they pay $2,000. It means accommodation, prasad, everything. But they have to do service. So, you know, they come and do service at the temple, or they also have some morning obligations they have to do. But if they go to the Bhagavatam class, then they don't have to do their morning program, you know, down at the yoga school. They don't have to do cleaning and stuff like that. So many of them, rather than do all the cleaning, they'll come to the Bhagavatam class. They think they're getting out of the service, but actually what's happening, as Prabhupada said, we're injecting the Krishna conscious poison into their dull wood-like brains. And they become purified. And we find after, you know, a few months, they're walking around with bead bags, chanting Hare Krishna. And then, you know, they're putting on dhoti and sari and things like that. You know, so it's quite effective. It's just a different preaching method. So we're finding that you know, there's more and more interesting preaching methods coming up. And they're effective. You know. So somehow or other, we have to cut through that material consciousness so the spiritual consciousness is reawoken, so that the jiva can reawaken their original relationship with Krishna. Because we see that, you know, these people, they just don't understand who they are. We don't understand who we are. Not in fact. We have some little understanding, some jnana, we have some knowledge, oh, I'm a servant of Krishna. But how often do we actually live that out? How often are we functioning like that, you know, especially when it comes to, you know, times when we can enjoy, or, you know, can we space out or watch a video or, you know, stuff like that. Then at those times we tend to forget. At least I can talk from my own experience, tend to forget that I'm a servant of Krishna. But we see with the condition that these living entities who have no perception of who they are, you know, they're just thinking that their business in life is to enjoy. So for them, we need to look at, you know, more and more how to inject Krishna consciousness into them. Yeah. Last sentence. This consciousness is inferior, destructible, and perverted. Very interesting. You know, Prabhupada makes quite strong statements. He says that this consciousness is inferior. It's inferior to spiritual consciousness. It's destructible. It's temporary. It comes and it goes. How long does a dog stay in a dog's body for? 15, 20 years? then the consciousness will change when it goes to the next body. And the next body, the next body, the next body. Same for us. We have our material conditioning. How long does that last? Even I saw this clip on Facebook yesterday. It was about reincarnation. And it was just kind of interesting, the interaction. That this guy, you know, he's there in wherever it was, you know, it's supposed to be not really heaven. It's kind of like a storefront sort of thing. And the guy's sort of talking to him over the counter. And he's showing him how temporary the whole bodily situation, because this guy's thinking, this is me. And he's wanting to go into his next body. And I can't remember what his name was, but he said, and will I still be Justin? I think he said something like that. He says, no, that's gone. That's finished, you know. And he's showing you how temporary. He's just like that. And he changes into another, you know, he disappears and then he comes back. And it's kind of interesting, just showing how short-lived it is. We're only in this body for a few short moments and then gone. And I was just speaking with a friend last night and their partner passed away a few months back. And they're still kind of like struggling with that whole notion of how the person's not there anymore. And of course, you know, like in the different situations, you need to be able to speak to people in a way that's going to sort of give them strength. I mean, I could have just sort of started to get real philosophical and say, well, you know, but we're all just temporary, but that wasn't the right thing for that time. But we need to understand that very deeply, how this conditioning, that this state we're in right now is so fleeting. You know, it's like, it only seems like yesterday I was 15 years old. And it's only going to be a few more years where I'm gone. Yeah? Then what? Where will I go next? It depends on my consciousness. So we need to become very, very aware of the fleeting nature of everything in this material world and not become attached to it. Because it's just like any possession we have, you know. You might have whatever it is, I don't know, like a nice dhoti or something like that, you know. And I was like, I was at Merle's place the other day, and I was loading things into the washing machine, and there was a sharp edge on the floor, on the coving on the tiles, which I didn't see. Nice dhoti, ripped, finished. And that's just material nature. It's just like that, you know. Comes and goes so quickly. Nothing's eternal, and that's what Prabhupada's saying. It's destructible. Everything in this world is destructible, and it's perverted. It's not the real thing. But super consciousness of the super mind in the spiritual plane is as good as the spirit soul and is never annihilated. So the spiritual consciousness is eternal. Once we achieve that spiritual consciousness, that doesn't change, that doesn't get affected by the modes of material nature. And that continues with us from life to life. You know, if we take more births in this material world, that consciousness will come out again. And we see even Rupa Goswami talks about this in the, I think it's the second chapter of the Nectar of Devotion, how he's saying, well, how do people come to Krishna consciousness? And he mentions that it's from past life experience. And then he explains, he says, you see that people, they'll come very quickly to a certain level in Krishna consciousness, then they seem to plateau and they slow down. So that's getting back to where they were in their past life. And then they progress steadily from there. And then he mentions the only way the person to come to Krishna consciousness, if they weren't doing it in a previous life, is through the association of a greatly advanced devotee. Like, you know, many devotees had the association of Srila Prabhupada. So through Srila Prabhupada's mercy, so many people have come to Krishna consciousness. And the same with Narad Muni. We see with Narad Muni, transcendental spaceman. He travels around the universe. And he's a significant acharya in our sampradaya. Because he's brought so many people to Krishna consciousness who normally would not have come to Krishna consciousness. And he's very, very powerful the way he's able to snap people out of their illusions. You know, we see the story of King Prachanabahi, for instance. He was deeply absorbed in his grihastha life. I mean, like, you know, grihastha life is sometimes compared to a well, and he was way down at the bottom of a very deep well. There's no way he was seeing, you know, that he was caught up in material life. And then Narad Muni, he explains this allegorical story to him about Paranjan. And then, you know, it goes on how Paranjan becomes a woman in his next life, and then it leads into the story about a goat, a he-goat and a she-goat. So he's going through, because first off, story of Paranjan, he didn't get it. Paranjan becomes a woman in his next life, he didn't get it. Then he starts telling the story about the he-goat and the she-goat. And at one point, Prachapati says, hey, wait a minute, I'm that goat. He gets it. You know, so Narad Muni, very expert preacher, and he's able to pull people out of this ignorance and restore them to this consciousness, this as Prabhupada calls it, this super consciousness, the spiritual consciousness of who they really are. And that's what Krishna consciousness is the purpose of the Krishna consciousness movement, is to enable people to understand who they really are. They're not this body, not this mind, not the senses. They're a spirit soul. They're a servant of Krishna. And that's, you know, that's our business, is to help them understand that. I've got no idea when I'm supposed to finish. Okay, so I'll finish. Any questions at all?